So last week we turned a corner in Luke's gospel. The first question that I told you was going to come up over and over and over again in this gospel of Luke is this question, who is the Christ? Who is this Jesus? And last week we hit this turning point in the gospel, the climax of the first section, when Jesus asked the disciples, but who do you say that I am? And Peter, having had his eyes opened, said, the Christ of God. Matthew in his gospel tells us that Peter said, you are the Christ, the Son of the Most High God. Jesus said that Peter was blessed and that God had revealed this to him. Next, you read in Matthew's gospel that we find that Jesus told Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. What's this rock? There's folks that mistakenly see that rock as Peter, but what he's saying is it's this declaration, it's this gospel of Jesus Christ. It's the fact that God is real and that God sent his Son, this Messiah, this promised one. It's on this that he will build his church. It's this one. You know, last week we spent some time and we really opened it up, right? It's the one who was promised in the garden. It's the Messiah. That's what Christ means. It's the one spoken of by the prophets, the one spoken of by the priests, the one that King David called out, the Savior of the world, the Lamb of God, the King of Kings. Jesus is him. It was surprising to us last week as we opened up that section that the very next thing Jesus tells the disciples is, now that you understand this, he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to nobody. You would think he would want this like broadcast on the rooftops. But the problem is they understood who he was, but they don't yet understand what he's really come to do. They had an expectation of what this Messiah would be and how this Messiah would act and the actions that this Messiah would take. Jesus is not going to meet any of those expectations in the way that they had them. And so they're not ready to share about this gospel yet. They didn't yet fully know what he came to do. And what Jesus does in the very next section in Luke's gospel is he explains to them the very first time that this plan of what this Messiah would do, what Jesus has come to do, is unveiled. And they're not expecting it, and they're not ready for it, and it's not at all what they wanted to hear. Remember what Jesus said last week? The Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by Israel and his people, be killed, and be raised on the third day. The disciples were not ready for that. And remember in Matthew's gospel, we get to hear what Peter said. Peter rebukes Jesus, right? He just gets done saying, you are the Christ, the Son of the Most High God. And within seconds, he says, no, that's not what you're going to do. Peter says, far be it from you, Lord. When Jesus says, this is what I came to do, I'm going to suffer, I'm going to die. Peter says, no, you're not. That's not what I want from my Messiah. This isn't the plan. That's not what my expectation is. That doesn't fit into where I'm going and what I'm thinking. That's not what I want for you. Remember what Jesus' response was to him? He calls Peter's statement, the previous statement that Peter makes, he says, this statement that you just made came from God. The very next statement that Peter makes, what does Jesus say? This statement came from the pit. This one came from hell itself. He tells Peter, get behind me, Satan. And then he explains to Peter what he means. Something that we need to hear this morning. He says, you're not setting your mind on the things of God. You have your mindset on the things of man. This is why I believe they were to remain silent about this mission of Christ, his identity, what he came to do, until after it had been completed. And even then, after, until the Spirit of God came upon them to be able to give them clarity and full understanding of what this gospel contains. But I pause here in this introduction for you just a minute, because this statement that Christ makes to Peter is something I believe, beloved, is so often true of us. It's the same correction that we need. You're setting your mind on the things of man instead of the things of God. We have our mindset on this life. What can I obtain? What do I need to do? And we fret so much over what we'll have or what we won't have, our plans, our expectations. And what we find is how often as we get close to the Lord does his expectations interfere with our own. How often when we really are close to the Lord in prayer and in his word does it interject and it takes us off course. And we, like Peter, go, no, that's not what I want. That's not my expectation. That isn't my plan. That's not what I want. The same rebuke comes to us. Get your mind off of this place. Get your mind onto him. Beloved, it's hard to get our minds set on the things of God. I'll share with you, it is a struggle. And what you're going to find in the message today is it's something that is going to be a daily struggle. I wish I could tell you as you get older, it gets going to get easier. No, it gets different, but probably not easier. Every day, we're going to struggle with this. Even in light of our Christ. You know, think about this. This is in the moment that Peter realized you are him. You really are the living God, his son. And in that same moment, I want you to do what I want you to do. And in that same moment of recognizing who he is, Peter comes off with this idea that, no, I'm not really in tune with your plan. I'd like you to get in tune with mine. If it happened to Peter in the presence of Jesus, I hope you understand this is a struggle. This is going to be hard for us. But there's hope, beloved, because Peter at this point didn't fully grasp the extent, the grace, the glory of God's great plan. This gospel of good news, what Jesus came to do, but he would later. And so I'm going to start this morning, and still in my introduction, going to Acts. Go to Acts chapter 2, because I think it's an encouragement for all of us. After the cross, with the Spirit of God at work in his life, this same Peter who said, I don't get what you're talking about. This is not what I want for you. This is not going to happen. This same Peter, probably about 2 years later after making this statement, preaches this sermon, Acts chapter 2, beginning with verse 22. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. He's on board now. He sees the plan. Do you see that? He's on board with it. According to this plan, foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it. For David says concerning him, I saw the Lord always before me, for he's at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore, my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. My flesh also will dwell in hope, for you will not abandon my soul to Hades or let your Holy One see corruption. He goes on, verse 29, brothers, I may say to you with confidence about the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Being therefore a prophet, knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up. And of that, we're all witnesses. There's hope. The same Peter that back in Luke says, no, I'm not on board with this plan. After having seen it, after having the Holy Spirit awakened him to the glory and the grace, the love and the mercy, all of that it contained, he's filled with the Spirit and he preaches it. He came to know the gospel in its fullness. He was a disciple who followed Christ. We know that Peter had some bumps along the road, but he was a disciple that followed. He came to set his mind on the things of God. My prayer this morning as we open this text is that those of us this morning who are on this side of the cross, who have had our eyes awakened to the fullness of the gospel and have been given his Spirit, would also, like Peter, determine to be disciples, to follow God in the way that Christ says we must. So our text for today is what follows next in Luke's Gospel, chapter 9. Beginning with verses 23, we're going to go through 26, but we're going to spend most of our time on verse 23. The word of the Lord. And he said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels." It's a great little section right there. We're going to stop at 26. We're just going to digest that piece today. There's a lot in there. Beginning with verse 23, "And Jesus said to all," I want you to understand this morning that he's speaking to all of the disciples. Earlier on in this section, we know that they've gathered together by themselves. He's there with the 12. He's just asked them the question, "Who do you say that I am?" We've gone through this section with Peter, who says, "You are the Christ." He says, "I've come to die." And Peter says, "No, you haven't." And he says, "Okay, not only is that wrong, but if you're going to follow me, this is what it means to follow me." Hard stuff, hard teaching that he's giving to all of the disciples. But I want you to understand that this all isn't just to his disciples. This morning, as we come to this passage, you're included in this all. If you truly are one who wants to follow Christ, if you truly are one who has believed and had your eyes opened to the truth of the gospel, then you too are a part of this all. In context, it's for his disciples. He's addressing the 12, including Peter. But I want you to understand that this all isn't just for the disciples. I want you to understand this morning that this all isn't just for pastors. It isn't just for missionaries. It isn't just for ministers. Because too often we think that, wow, to really give up everything to follow Christ, well, they've been called to that. No, it isn't. You're a part of this all. You have been called to this. When he says, "Anyone who determines to come after me will," he says, "let them do this, let them do this, and let them do this." And so this morning, as we go forward, I don't want you to turn off saying, "Well, that's not me. I'm just a pew sitter. I'm just a sheep in the fold." Beloved, before the beginning of time, the Almighty God placed his love upon you. And in the fullness of time, he awakened you to the truth of his Son, Jesus Christ. And he called you to follow him. This is for you. And so, verse 23, "If anyone would come after me." What he's saying is, if you call yourself a Christian, right? If you really are a disciple, if you're really going to follow me, if anyone would be, if you call yourself a follower, if you have determined to follow him, if you're a believer, true Christian, then, do you see that there's a kind of an if-then statement? There's an if-then, this is true, then let this be true of you. Do you see the implication? What he's about to say is, if you are a true follower of me, then let him deny, let him take up, and let him follow. It's not, maybe you should deny yourself, maybe you should take up your cross, maybe you should follow him a little while. No, he's saying, if you really are a follower of Christ, this is what it means to follow. So Jesus is telling his disciples, if you're a true follower, a real disciple of mine, and think about the context. This is right after Peter says, no, I don't want you to suffer. I don't want you to be rejected. I don't want you to die. I want to go in riding on the donkey. I want to go in power. I want to go in and oust the Romans. I want you to come in and put Israel right. I want us to come in victory. What do you mean you're going to die? Suffer. Jesus says, that comes from the pit. You're only thinking about yourself. You're thinking of this life. Stop. Put your mind on the things of God. Peter, if you're going to follow me, this is what it looks like. And he begins, 3 points. He gives 3 points. They're all the same. If you really go into the Greek and define them, they're all basically saying the same thing, but he uses 3 different Greek verbs, which each have a nuance. And so this morning we're going to preach the nuances, because I think that they're important for you to see as they come together. And so the very first one that he gives is, let him, if anyone would come after me, first let him deny himself. I will tell you right off, you're not going to like this one. This is one, probably of the three, that you are not going to like. The Greek word is arneomai. It's a very, very strong word of negation. What do you mean negation? What is a negation word? What does that mean exactly? It means to put aside, to put against. He's asking you to go against yourself. Put yourself aside is kind of the idea. Let me give you a sample. If your friend says, you owe me $5, and you say, no, I don't, the statement you just made is a negation. No, you think that about me, but that's not true. Let me tell you what is true about me. I don't owe you $5. Get it? Another example, when the butler says, I didn't kill Miss Green in the kitchen with the butcher knife, that's a negation. You may think that just because I'm the butler and I look kind of creepy and I'm carrying a knife, that I'm the one who killed her in the kitchen, but that's not true about me. What you think of me is no longer true of me. A negation. It's a denial that says, this is not true of me. What you think of me should be put aside. What you think of me should be put against. What you think of me is contradictory to what is true of me. Isn't that full? When I was like started pulling out the Greek, isn't that a full definition? When we think, oh, I need to deny myself. We don't really know what that means. We kind of put it all together and we're like, yeah, it just means I can't do the stuff I want to do, and now I got to do the stuff, you know, for him. No, just stop for a moment. And the very first thing he says is, what was true about you before is no longer true about you now. And you need to be able to declare that. You need to be able to understand that. In context, Jesus says, if anyone would follow me, let him deny himself, put himself aside, forget oneself. To say what was true of me before is now contradictory to who I am now. I am no longer myself. Turn to Galatians. Galatians chapter 2. Paul does a really good job here as he's writing to the Galatians. It's a verse that you've probably heard or memorized, maybe. Chapter 2, verse 20. I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Do you see that verse? Do you see it in light now of what it means? This is a denial of self. This is what used to be true of me is no longer true of me. You see, because I was crucified, that old self was crucified with Christ. It's now gone. And now it's no longer I who live, but it's Christ who's living in me. There's something new. There's something different. Jesus is calling his disciples to this. So that they can say with Paul, it's no longer I who live, it's Christ who lives in me. I'm not my own. We understand later when Paul says, to live is Christ. Christ says, if you're going to follow me, anyone who does must deny himself. He must negate himself. He must put aside, put against himself. Beloved, what does that look like? You know, it's easy. We get into those definitions. We're like, wow, that's a fuller definition. But what does that look like? What do I do with that? Do we know how to put ourselves aside? We're not very good at that. And so what I found for me to be helpful was I do know what it means to validate myself, which is kind of the opposite, right? I know what it takes for me to get validation. What are the things that validate me? Well, as I went through the list, right? How do we validate ourselves? How do we live for ourselves? Well, one of the ways I'm validated is by my bank account. How much money do I have? That's a validation. By our relationships. How many friends do I have? How many relationships do I have? How popular am I? That's a validation. Our jobs. Too many of us live by our jobs. I'm guilty. We're identified and validated by the work we do. How much does my boss love me? How much does my workers respect me? How much does, you know, and I'll tell you, guys, this is just a side note for the guys. They love you because you're sacrificing everything else. It's not love. It's one. I would tell you, I fought this for 20 years because I wanted every boss, everyone I ever worked for or with to love me. And so I sacrificed my family, I sacrificed my ministry, I sacrificed so much in order to gain a love that I found out when I finally left that I was replaced 3 months later. And they loved him just as much. And a lot was lost. You don't get those 20 years back. Too many of us validate ourselves by our jobs, by our homes. How nice is my zip code? By our appearance, how good do I look? How many people look at me? By our Facebook, how many people like the stupid post I posted last night? Tell me you don't do that. You make a cute little funny post, and then you wait to see, do they like it? And it's like, ooh, 6, 9, 14, 20, ooh. We validate ourselves, don't we? With tweets and with posts. Even by our charity, even the good things we do. How many lives have I changed? How many people saw how many lives I changed? You can fill in the blank, right? You kind of get it now? There's a lot of places that we validate ourselves. And what I want you to understand that this Greek word for deny is the opposite of validate. And so what he's saying is, do not validate yourself anymore. Deny yourself. These things aren't worth it. We can pretty much understand what it is to validate ourselves. We spend so much time, so much worry, so much resource, so much energy trying to validate ourselves. So, beloved, what does it look like to deny ourselves, to negate ourselves, to come to a place where we can say, it's no longer I who live? It means my bank account doesn't matter. It doesn't validate me anymore. It means my relationships are no longer about how many. It means my job is just a job. The home is the place I live. My appearance is what it is. We die to self. It's no longer about me. No longer afraid of what people think. No longer obsessed with getting ahead. No longer worried about keeping my stuff, keeping my appearances, keeping my status, keeping my rights. It's no longer about making people love me anymore. I no longer need to validate myself because my God has sent his son for me. The God, the living creator, the almighty one has placed his love upon me and sent his son to die for me. If you need more validation than that, there's something wrong. It's no longer I who live. I deny myself. From now on, I live for him. That's the first one. And I want you to see something this morning as you look at that first one. It's not self-hatred, is it? It's not an ascetic living, right? You're not going to become a Buddhist monk. The Buddhists look at this and say, no, I want to get rid of all of these things so that I can be free, right? To kind of float around and not have any of these worries. No, this isn't for you. I want you to understand this morning, it isn't about self-hatred. It isn't about just cutting away all these things. Jesus says, stop living for yourselves. Start living for me. He's not calling you not to live for something. He's saying he's calling you to live for something that matters. I will tell you, it's counterculture for us today, no doubt. He's calling them to forget themselves. You know, kind of a side note, but I leave it in. Think of how self-focused we've become as a culture. Have you thought about it? How much of your life revolves around your desires, your pleasures, your wants, your preferences, your benefits, your rights, your freedoms, your choices, your earnings, your savings, your opinions, and so on. We craft a life around ourselves, and much of the technology and the big changes that we've seen happen in our culture are to give us more of what we want for ourselves, aren't they? Whether it's the music I listen to, whether it's the friends that I like or unlike. I can surround myself with only the stuff I want. I can eat what I want. I can listen to what I want. I can see what I want. We can craft our lives around me. Until I want something else. Jesus is calling his disciples. He says, if you come after me, that life of self-focus, that life of self-indulgence, that life of being self-consumed must be arneomai, denied. No longer true of you. You no longer need to validate yourself because Christ has come and God has sent his son because of you. And he sent his son if it was only you. So first he calls them and us to put down something. That old way of life, living for ourselves. Next he tells us to take up something. Right? You see how that goes? First put down, now take up. If anyone should come after me, then he must take up his cross daily. The Greek word here is iro. It means taking and lifting for yourself. Right? This is not just a group of us go to lift something up. This is an individual going and lifting this up. This is you, coming back to the all of you, this is you lifting and taking something up. So this is on you. I will tell you a side note here. This is a truly side note. I hear too often, oh, this is my cross to bear. Ever heard that? Ever hear that? And usually, what are they talking about? My naggy wife. Well, that's my cross to bear. You know, or it's some bad habit. Well, that's my cross to bear. Right? It's usually something stupid. Do you see what it says? It doesn't say to take up your cross daily. It says to take up his. This is his cross. That's a good way to remember this. It isn't just some nuisance that's in your life, something you have to put up with. No, this isn't anything like that. That's too weak of an understanding of what this is. He says, you're going to have to take up this cross, my cross. You know, we have a beautiful affection for the cross, don't we? We wear it as jewelry. We place it everywhere because we love the cross. Because when we look at the cross, it represents God's glory. It represents his love. It represents his grace. It's his mercy. And so we love the cross. In context, when he brought this up to the disciples, they didn't love the cross. They hated the cross. For these disciples, the picture was not beautiful at all. It wasn't a call to share with Jesus in his glory and his grace. No, for them, it was a call to share in his agony and his suffering and his shame. You see that? It was another graphic way of saying to what extent they were going to arneomai. When you deny yourself, I'm going to give you the extent of it. Beloved, they'd seen men in their towns and villages called out by the Roman guards. Saw these men forced to take up the cross that was laid out in front of their house. When the Roman guards would come to a house, they would lay the cross out in front. And then they would call the man out from the village, and he would lift that cross, and then he would carry it. And as he would take up that cross, people of the town would turn their backs. This was someone who was filled with shame. This was humiliating. This was excruciating. This was dehumanizing. This was executioning. This was a dead man walking. To see someone take up their cross would cause you to just stop and to be sick to your stomach, to wonder what he had done, to be ashamed of him, to be sorry for him. What a pathetic, horrible fate. And Jesus says, take up my cross daily. Deny yourself and take up his cross. He isn't just calling them to die to self. He's calling them to crucify it. Beloved, we ought to be careful as we call out things in our life as the cross that we bear. Oh, this is the cross that I take up. When we link it to financial struggles or difficult relationships or bad habits, we do a disservice to the cross. That's not at all what he means here. It's not at all close to the context of what Jesus was telling his disciples. Paul wrote to the Galatians in 5:24, he says, and those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. It's not just dying to self, it's crucifying those things. It's allowing ourselves to be brought to Christ, to go with him, even to the cross. One commentator wrote this. I love this. It's only three paragraphs, but it's going to seem long. He who desires to become his disciple and servant will every day, have to be willing to put his own wishes and interests into the background and to accept voluntarily and wholeheartedly the sacrifice and suffering that will have to be endured in the service of Christ. The cross is not the ordinary human troubles and sorrows such as disappointments, disease, death, poverty, and the like. No, but these are things that have to be suffered. Things that have to be endured, sacrificed, and lost in the service of Christ. Vituperation, great word. Some of you, I didn't know it. Vituperation means bitter and abusive language. People aren't going to like you when you do this. Persecution, self-sacrifice, suffering, even unto death as a result of our true faith and obedience to Christ. Wow. We don't often think about it that way. We've gotten too used to making a joke out of our cross to bear. Peter shows us the result of this living truth of what to expect. If you go to 1 Peter, some of you know this verse. I just shared it last week with a couple of young men. 1 Peter 4. Since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, and so as to live for the rest of its time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. For the time is past. Suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality and passions and drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, lawless idolatry. Look at verse 4. And with respect to this, they're surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery. And they malign you. But they'll give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. Peter wants you to have no mistake. When you live this way, it isn't going to make people happy. When you take up his cross, you know, when you take up your cross, people go, oh yeah, we all suffer. And misery loves company. You'll have lots of friends when you're just suffering with all the stuff we talked about. But when you take up his cross, there'll be a difference. And the friends and the co-workers and the people that you have surrounding you in your life, they're going to look at you and they're going to be convicted by the fact that you have changed. Luke told me that last week before he left. He said, so many of his friends don't want to be around him anymore. He said, that's all right. And he says, and I don't judge them. He goes, I've never once judged them. They see that his life has transformed, and that convicts. Being around someone who's living for Christ convicts, doesn't it? Even Christians, as we're alongside thriving Christians, don't you sometimes leave in the car going, oh, I need to change. Wow, that was beautiful, and that's broken in my life. Think what it is to non-believers, non-Christians, to be around it. They just can't even stomach it. So he says, don't be surprised when they malign you, talk bad about you, betray you, kick you out of the group. They, your friends, your coworkers, your old circle of influence, they're surprised when you no longer join in. And they will be critical. And secondly, you know, in this section thing, what you need to see in this section is it says it isn't once and for all. This time where I came to Christ and I accepted that cross, that was me taking up my cross. No, it's not once I took up my cross. It's not every once in a while I take up the cross. I put in here a side note for Rob. This isn't for you. This is occasional cross lifting. How many of you are occasional cross lifters? Christ was very firm daily. Daily. They need to take up his cross daily. In Romans 8, this section, I'm running out of time, so I won't go there, but basically Paul's talking about being crucified with Christ. He makes the point that those with the mind set on the flesh, they're hostile to God. They can't please God because they've set their mind on the flesh. And he says, and the end of that is death. But those in Christ, those of the Spirit, they've set their minds on him. And what he says is they have put to death the things of the flesh. And what's really cool in the Greek is that is a present active tense. It means they are continually putting to death. That's what you need to understand. Take up your cross daily. Continually be putting to death these things that take you away from the cross of Christ. It's not easy stuff. Taking up a cross is humiliating. It's a spectacle. People look away. But I want you to know something. Gosh, this is really important in this. Jesus didn't go through the cross just to go through it. Some of you are going, duh, what are you saying about that? Something really important, especially a couple of questions that have come up from some of the young guys recently. He wasn't just checking a box on the redemption plan checklist. Okay? Here's all the stuff you need to go do when you get to, down to the earth and go through and check all these things off. One of them is suffering. One of them is getting spit at. One of them is getting mocked. One of them is going to the cross. And so Jesus wasn't going through this checklist going check, 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 check. He took up his cross for you. It was out of obedience to his Father and out of his love for you. So in return, when you take up your cross, don't make it a checklist. He didn't. Don't make it part of my Christian morality, my Christian piety to say, well, if I'm going to be a Christian, then I guess I have to do this. I need to get rid of that. I need to get rid of that. I need to stop doing that. I need to stop thinking that way. Because then you're going to end up with one of those Christians who walks around all the time with a frown on their face because look at all the stuff I had to give up for Christ. My life is total crud now. It's boring. All the stuff I want to do, I don't get to do, and I'm completely stuck. But I'm saved. I guess heaven will be better than here. No, in the same way that Christ, I picture when Peter is denying him out at the fire, and it says in one of the Gospels that their eyes met. I don't see Christ looking at Peter going, I told you were going to screw it all up. I see Christ looking and saying, Peter, I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. love you. I love you. It'll be okay. I love you. So that later on, when they come in the boat and someone says, hey, who's that on the shore? And they say, it's Jesus. Peter's out of the boat, swimming to shore to get to this one he loves. When we take up our cross, we do so out of obedience. He told us to. But we take up our cross out of love. We love him because he first loved us. And so it isn't blind obedience. This isn't a dead checklist item in the book of what we're supposed to do. Do you love him? He loves you. It wasn't a side action that he was doing when he went to the cross. He had you on his mind. Have you ever thought about that? So when you deny yourself and take up your cross, have him on your mind. It makes it easier, isn't it, to go, man, I really want that cheesecake, but I'm going to pass up on it. For you, Lord, I'll be disciplined. For you, I'll change. For you, I'll reach out to that person I haven't reached out to that bugs me. For you, I'll do this. For you, I'll stop that. For you, I'll start that. For you, I'll sacrifice. For you, I'll do anything. I love you. I'm not going to get to the rest of the verses. I'm going to leave you with the last one. Follow. If anyone would come after me, deny himself, arneomai, take up his cross daily, iro, and akolutheo, follow. This akolutheo is a stronger following. It's a military following. It's a following to the end. Whether we win or we lose, that follow is to follow into battle, come what may, to the end. It's not just to follow his teaching. It's not just to follow his ethics. It's not just to follow for a while and then to drift and then to follow again. It's not just to follow his commands, but to follow him to the cross. Ekaletheo is to follow him all the way to the cross, all the way to the grave, all the way to the resurrection. I am not who I used to be. I have crucified the flesh, and it is now Christ who lives in me. I deny myself, for I am now his. I take up my cross daily because he took up his cross for me. And I will take up his cross. And whatever that means in my life, whatever plans have to shift, whatever things, passions that I have that are inconsistent with that will be taken away, because I will take up my cross. And I know that it's going to be sacrificial. I know that there's going to be times where I'm humiliated and humbled and shamed. I know that everyone around me is going to not like me the same as they used to. I know that folks are going to be convicted as I walk around. I'm not going to be invited to parties anymore. I'm not going to, the list goes on, and I know all of those things, but I will take up my cross, your cross, and follow you to the end. The last section you can read is a devotional this week. What is it to basically the man that basically lived his life? He spent his whole life living for himself. At the end of it, what does he have? Nothing. Isn't it sad for the guy who tries to save his life and then ends up losing it? He says, no, the one who loses his life for my sake, he's the one who saves it. Beloved, verse 25, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, loses himself? Beloved, that's a question verse many of you have memorized, but you don't have it memorized as a question. There's a question mark at the end of that verse. And the question is, what does it profit a man? And the answer that you need to know more than the verse is nothing. It profits him nothing. At the end of his life, this man who's worked 60, 80 hours a week for 40 years, who doesn't know his daughter, who doesn't know his grandkids, who has to reacquaint with his wife, who has not served in the church, who has not given himself to the Lord. At the end of his life, he looks back, and all of that was for nothing. Truisms that he gives you at the end of this. Whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory, the glory of the Father, the glory of the angels. So as we come to the table this morning, if you are a believer in Jesus Christ, if you truly come after Jesus and you're truly his, then you will, Arne Omai, you will deny yourself. You're no longer who you were. You will outgrow. You'll take up your cross daily, and you will sacrifice, suffer, and put to death everything that keeps you away from being transformed by his Spirit and by the Son. And you will akaluthēo. You'll follow where he leads, even to the cross, even to the grave, even unto glory. Losing my life for Jesus that I may save it. Giving up the world that I might not lose him. Not being ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation. Never being ashamed of him or his words, that I might be his. That I know that I am his until he comes again.